Hello and welcome to Two Fat Expats. And when we say fat, we're not talking bathroom scales or excess luggage. Two Fat Expats are all about making the most of your expat adventure and filling it up with as much as you can so that when it's all over, there's no regrets. You've lived a fat expat life. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie expat who's based in Doha, Qatar, and I'm joined by Nikki Moffat.
Hello.
Another Aussie, but Nikki's in Hamburg, Germany. We've lived in 12 countries between us. We consider ourselves experts in all matters of the geographically challenged. Between us, we've given birth in 6 different countries. We know what it's like to pack up yet another kitchen, start looking for another job, and wave goodbye to that brilliant hairdresser it took you 12 months to find. We've both made those first steps into the brand new office, or worse, the new school, and at times we've found ourselves jobless, friendless, and starting afresh all over again. Each week, we talk to expats who are all over the world. We discuss our favourite finds, our biggest stuff-ups, and we get the best tips for packing it all in. Okay, are we ready? Let's do this. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Kirsty Rice. And how are you?
I'm good. I am 1 day away from 2 of my children arriving back in the country. So that's all a little bit exciting. And it's Thursday for me. So it's the end of the week, which is fantastic.
That is good. And how are you doing with your friendship quest? 5 friends for Christmas.
I'm on fire. I've made 2 new friends so far and I've got ideas. Sort of, what would you call simmering away, or I've got friendship plans simmering away. So I think in the first week, well, I talked about sort of reaching out to friends of friends of friends, you know, for coffees and whatever. And I went out for a coffee with Trish, who I absolutely loved. I thought she was fantastic and had a great lunch with her. And then this week I went all by myself to a Indian cooking class and it was fantastic. Nikki, even if I hadn't have met anyone, just the food was really, really amazing. And to watch, I think to stand in someone's kitchen and watch how they just be able to say, where did you buy that? Where did you get that? Why do you do that? Oh my God, look at that. Do you know, it was really, really good.
Yeah. So at our school, they have not a commercial kitchen. They have a commercial kitchen for the cafeteria and then they have another kitchen. It's sort of a big kitchen. And we have there on a regular basis, the PTA runs country cooking classes. So the Indian ladies come in and teach you how to cook curries.
Yeah.
And they tell you where to buy the ingredients for particular things. And then the Italian ladies come and show you how to cook Italian dishes. And it's really fun. I don't get to as many as I should, but it's great as well. So, yeah, but it's not quite the same as being in someone's home and seeing it done that way.
And I just think, you know, with Indian cooking, there's so many. One of the things that Rena was doing was she'd bring out a spice jar from her kitchen and it would be turmeric. And she'd say, smell that. And you'd go, oh yeah, I've got that turmeric at home, you know, thinking you're all very authentic. And you'd smell it. And then she'd say, now smell my turmeric that I ground. And it was just like 2 different things. Like they just didn't even smell anywhere near each other. Just everything she did packed more punch just by the fact that she ground everything herself. And things I learned about, like, you know, different spices she'd put in, and she'd say, oh, I'm putting that in solely just for your digestion, because we were having paneer pakora. So it was, you know, the deep fried paneer. Oh my God, Nikki, it was so good. I'm making it this weekend because I've been dreaming about it all week. But, you know, just she'd say, oh, I'm putting this spice in because, you know, pakora is bad for your indigestion because it's fried food and whatever, but this will stop that happening. Or I'm putting this in here, or I do my garam masala like this. And even down to what she used gram flour. Have you ever used gram flour?
Well, funny you should ask. I have. because for one of my cookbook clubs, I had to go to the Indian shop and buy some.
Yes. And for those listening at home that are like me and hadn't ever had to do that, gram flour is chickpea flour. So if you're a vegan or gluten intolerant, or you're a bit like me at the moment and doing the 800 fast with Dr. Mosley, gram flour just ticks all the boxes. It's fantastic. So yeah, I learned lots, and then you sit down with people that you've done the cooking lesson with, and you eat the meal together, and you know, of course, you're meeting new people, and you know, it's all that kind of nervy, you know, we're all standing here learning something new and none of us really know each other and we're all just trying this out, but it was great. Anyway, let's get on with the show, Nikki Moffat. Okay, this week's episode was inspired by an ABC article about how tough it is to find a job back in your home country after being an expat. Now, I just want to be really clear that the podcast is not about how to find a job while you're an expat. We're going to cover that later on. And it's also not about how to find a job after being on a long extended break from work because you've moved for someone else's career. We'll also cover that one later on, so listen out for that further on down the track. But this podcast is all about if your expat career is stunting your career prospects at home. Now, the headline said it all. It said, thinking of moving overseas for work, it's tough to find a job when you return. And I'll put a link to the article in our on our website and in our show notes. But Nikki, it really got me thinking, because I've been an expat for over 20 years, and I'd like to know if you can remember, because you're also a long-term expat, take yourself back to the beginning of your journey. What did you think taking a job overseas would do for your career? Because I think that we perhaps foolishly thought it was going to be a career boost. What about you?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I thought. Imagine that. Oh, wow, living and working overseas and then coming back to little old Australia in this part of the world and saying, I've got all this international experience. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be great. It's going to put me in such a good position.
Yeah. I definitely, and I definitely remember, you know, sort of telling friends that we were going and the job opportunities that were ahead, and yeah, really believing, oh, this is going to be huge because I'm going to expose myself, you know, to other multinationals. And I think, you know, particularly, yes, for my husband, because when we left, I was pregnant and he was going into a bigger job. But also I then went to work. I used to work in recruitment, and I went to work for a big multinational in North America, and I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be really good for my career later on.
And I went to Hong Kong and worked for an Australian company, but it was on an international basis. So I thought, wow, that's even maybe a double bonus.
Yeah. So I wonder, is it all in the timing? Is the trick not to stay away for too long? I think one of our members, Shelley, made a really good observation. She said, we all leave home with skills and experience but no network. So when we're all heading off on this overseas adventure, we don't have a network then, but we've chosen for the position because of our skills and our experience. And we're valued additions even though we don't have that network. But when it comes back to repatriation, it's completely the reverse. Aussie companies are looking outside the country for global experience and they import it. It just doesn't make any sense.
It's also the work pyramid. So when you leave the country for work, you're usually leaving sort of at the beginning or in the middle, early middle stages of your career.
True.
So if you look at the funnel and you look at the funnel like a little pyramid, and, you know, the older you get, or the more experience, actually not always age, but the more experience and the more senior your job roles, the less options there are in any organization.
Yeah.
Because when you leave and you're in middle management or the middle of the organization, there's the world's your oyster. You can basically do anything. And you don't mind moving sideways or even a little bit down if it's going to get you different sorts of experience. But when your career gets further and you've had more experience and more in depth and senior roles, you often don't want to say, okay, yeah, I'll change that all back for something else. So it's I think it's a double-edged sword. We've also always talked about, you know, why you like living somewhere because of the age you are or the stage in your life. And I think it's another thing. So what you said about, do you leave it too long? Do you come back before you're at that level where you don't have many options, or do you make a different plan? Yeah.
And I also wonder, Nikki, is it a tall poppy thing in Australia? Like, who do they think they are coming back here and they're going to, you know, take this job, you know, that kind of small-minded job for the boys? Or do expats just have a really bad rap? But I was going to say, with the tall poppy thing, I always think about sitting with my husband. We went back to Australia for Christmas, and a friend who's been in Adelaide forever and has made his career there, my husband offhandedly said, oh, I think I'll join the golf club. And I could sense that he might as well had just said, you know, I think I'll just stick my finger in the middle of your yogurt on your plate there. because you could see that this person was thinking, oh, you just don't join the golf club, you know, you have to be invited. And I've been on that list, you know, for however many years, or my father played for that golf club, or, you know, whatever. There was that whole, I suddenly felt this, hang on, you don't just think you're going to come back here and have that life because you haven't earned it yet.
Yeah. And that's absolutely true. And that, you know, it's part of this very complex situation where what your husband said is perfectly fine, and what the other guy said is also perfectly fine, in that it's not necessarily tall poppy, it's just his whole cultural identity is based around those things.
Yes.
And parents put him on the list for the golf membership when he was born, and then he became a junior member, and then he became a senior member, and these things happen. Yeah. And he's never moved to another country and done things differently. This is the way it's always been done here. And yeah. I think the tall poppy thing comes into play also when recruiting overseas talent. So people look at Australians and think, oh, they've had all that overseas experience, but they don't have a different accent. So if we bring someone in to be CEO of our company that has a different accent, like, then they're speaking with authority. I don't know. I still think there's something a little bit about that in Australia. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I know there's been a lot of articles about this. So I wonder whether there's someone think tank paying people to write articles to stop the brain drain, to stop all the people leaving Australia to work overseas.
Don't leave because you'll never get let back in.
No, I'm just saying, someone somewhere has always got an agenda. See, that's how I think these days.
Not cynical at all. Okay, I interviewed Jane, whose husband really struggled to get a job when they returned to Australia. Jane and her husband had immigrated to Australia years and years ago, and so they knew that they'd be returning there. After 18 months of trying and burning through their savings, which I cannot imagine the stress of, you know, going away, saving, coming back and spending it all while you're waiting to find a job. Jane's husband ended up taking another expat gig, and she has remained back in Australia. Anyway, I began by asking her, when they took off on their expat life, how long they thought they'd be away for. You know, did they think they'd be away for that long, and what their original plan was?
Well, that was the deal I made with my husband, because when he wanted to go and live overseas, I said, okay, I will go for 10 years, because I didn't really want to leave Australia at the time.
Yes.
And that was before we had a family. So I had this magical figure in my head of 10 years, and it actually turned out to be 14 in the end.
Oh, wow.
But that was then ruled by having a child who was 11 at the time and wanting to come back to Australia for high school.
How long did the job hunt start for, like, from when you're in Qatar and thinking, okay, we've got to get back to Australia? How long was that process?
Well, the job ended in Qatar more sooner than we'd expected, so
right.
A bit of a shock.
And what sort of work, if you don't mind me asking, what sort of work was he looking for in Australia?
looking for a senior administration role, particularly in the education market, higher education.
So would you say that's quite specific, that there aren't a lot of jobs in that area in the first place?
Yeah, he's looking at a pretty senior level. So someone in, he's now in mid-50s, so has already reached a senior level. So it's not something where there's thousands of jobs, but with all his experience, should have been something that, you know, people would be looking for.
Yes, and a lot of people wouldn't be aware that Qatar has some of the most prestigious sort of higher education organisations as well, doesn't it?
Yes, some of the top American universities have campuses in Qatar. So, yeah, he's working with a top 100 university, but that experience is not deemed any use, particularly back in Australia. We found it very parochial.
Now,
not
why
interested
is...
in the Australian experience at all.
Why is that? Because, I mean, I'm Australian and I would have thought that if someone had worked for a high-end or, prestigious American university and they were returning to Australia with all of that experience of what it's like to work for one of those big organisations, do you really think it just didn't account for anything? That people were almost like, well, that's got nothing to do with us, so you won't understand us. Was it more that sort of feeling?
Yes, to be honest, I think it was. I mean, he was sort of told on a number of occasions that you don't have the recent local experience, even though a lot of these roles it's quite sort of generic. It's you don't need to be specifically aware of what was going on in that market exactly. I mean, he'd kept abreast of everything that's happening in the education market, but it was they just wanted someone that had been here, been working here. That, I mean, well, that was what he was told, whether that's always just an excuse, but he was, down to the final couple on a number of occasions, some big roles, but always picked at the post. So
yes, yeah.
It was very disappointing.
So how long did it go for that your husband wasn't able to find work? What was the cutoff point where you went, well, we've got to start looking overseas again?
Yeah, well, it took a total of 18 months. Till he got a job. So he started looking after about a year. He was looking overseas, various places, just in case. And so after 18 months, a good role came up, but it was a country that I didn't want to move to. Mm. So we had to make a decision for him to go and us to stay.
And so now I guess you're a single parent while he's working away, and Do you have a timeline for how long he'll be away for?
Yes, he's intending to be away for just under 3 years.
Right.
And he'll hit 60.
Right.
And then he said that's it, he'll come back, and I'm going to hold him to that. who knows, how long, whether it'll, last that long or not. I mean, it's all still fairly early days. But, so far it's working okay. But it's just, it's just a shame that you can't get a job back here. We just feel we were quite naive probably in thinking, oh, yeah, we'll just go back to Australia after so many years and get jobs. And it's not so simple, especially if you're a little bit older.
Do you think that he may have been a bit of a victim of ageism? Do you think that perhaps if you'd started the trek back maybe 5 years earlier, he would have been better off?
Maybe. I think it was probably a combination of ageism and being away.
Yes.
I think if you were coming here in your 30s or 40s, maybe it'd be easier. I think in your 50s, you've got lots of things against you, and also he's also now victim of possibly in the industry he's in and the positions he's doing, they're actually looking for more diversity.
Right.
The middle-aged white men are not actually the prime candidates anymore. So you actually almost it's going the other way.
Do you think that if he had perhaps sort of been trying to nurture relationships in the years that he was away, like I've seen quite a few people suggest that you should be on your trips back to your home country, having coffees, starting to meet people, starting to try and let people know you're out there.
Well, we sort of knew we would be in Brisbane, and we'd bought a house here about 4 years ago. So we were coming back to Brisbane on trips. So, and he did very much do that. Whenever we came back, he would actually meet with recruiters for coffee and think people that he knew. So he would connect just to stay in touch, although obviously we didn't exactly know the time frame of when we'd be back. But, you know, he did reach out to people quite regularly.
Yeah, if you had any advice to give, what would it be?
Well, it would be, yeah, be prepared to have to work hard to get a job. Don't think you're just going to walk straight into something, and sort of start your networking early, you know, whilst you're still away. I think you really do need to start planning it and sort of have a sort of backup plan, some backup funds, because you may have to spend longer than you think living off your hard-earned savings, because it's not necessarily going to fall into place straight away.
If you had your chance to do it all again, would you do it all again, or would you do a few things a little bit differently?
I certainly would go overseas, because you know, that turned out to be an amazing experience. So I don't regret being an expat at all. So I really like that. But I think, yeah, I would have made slightly different plans and just, thought about it a bit more carefully. We did. We just assumed, made a lot of assumptions.
Great tape, Kirsty. Great tape. That's what I thought when I listened. I thought that you hit all the key points, all the areas that people want to know about. You know, what were you thinking, and how hard did you think it was be? And also some of the things that we've just talked about in terms of age dependency. But also another thing that was raised, I think, is that people don't necessarily understand what the experience has been of somebody who's lived and worked overseas. So that's could be a market thing as well. So you talked about in Qatar, there's a lot of top universities there. And they have campuses, and obviously that's where Jane's husband worked. But if you don't think about it in that way, oh, how good can it be? You know, like it's in Qatar, you know, that kind of thing. Like if you're coming from an Australian market and you're not in the international education market, you might not necessarily understand that.
Yes, yes. I thought it was really interesting when she was saying about he'd gone back and spoken to recruiters, you know, because I wonder if that's the key. You know, I guess I think a really big thing is keeping those networks open. I mean, for me, with, you know, me talking about recruiting and whatever, I look at now who the people I worked with, and yes, I do maintain probably friendships with them. And I think I could probably weasel myself a job somewhere along the way, but I have been out of it for too long. Do you know, it's things have changed, and I'd have to go in as a junior doobie, and I can't see that happening. So one of the things I did with my career is I just basically changed careers, upskilled, and just moved into a completely different area. So it's worked, I guess for me, it's worked really well in that point, you know, the whole expat thing, because I've found something that I can do on a mobile basis, and I've found someone who's done very well, you know, that I work with. And so that side of it as well. But I had to completely change career for that to happen. I think if I look at the person I live with, my husband, and he looks at going back to Australia, he has to be very honest with himself and say he will never get the same job back in Australia, because it basically doesn't exist, because he works for a company that is absolutely massive, and there just isn't a company in Australia on that scale, you know, in his industry. Yeah, there's nothing comparative. So, and you know, maybe he'd have to do another degree, which he finds, you know, would be really tough going with the work that he puts in. I thought it was interesting. Someone on our Facebook group wrote something about expats being lazy or perceived as lazy. And I think there's a lot of people in the Middle East that would really struggle with that, because you are a worker bee when you come to the Middle East. You know, you're there for a reason. You are brought in specifically to do a job, and you will do that job. And if you don't do that job, there's plenty of other worker bees that will do it. And I wonder if that's industry specific though too. She did mention banking.
Yeah, Yeah, but I also don't think that because, I mean, I worked in banking in Hong Kong and I didn't see expats being lazy at all. I saw them working really long hours.
Yes.
Getting stuff done. And wherever we've worked, I mean, my husband has worked ridiculous hours. And we talked about, you know, oh, you know, Europe has such great, you know, what's it called? Work-life balance. I don't even remember what it's called. but he does. And he says, you know, my whole team is never in the office because everyone's always on maternity, paternity with their child, you know, 8 weeks, annual leave, whatever. But I don't see him doing that. Like he always feels as the person they've brought in from somewhere else to do a job that he has to, you know, he doesn't have to work the longest or whatever, but he feels that he has to deliver. And I've never seen him work short hours and I have never worked shorter hours. I found that an interesting comment, but you know, it's a fair comment because someone made it and it's their lived experience. So
yeah,
it's worth probably investigating, but yeah,
hasn't been my experience.
It definitely hasn't been my experience either.
But I wonder, Nikki, too, I think one of the things, because this whole thing keeps coming up about age and how long you're away for, you know, go away for 5 years, you're fine, you'll get a job. Go away for 10 years, things are starting to look a little bit more sketchy. Go away for 20, well, God, who are you? Do you even, you know, I vaguely remember you. And I think that's something you need to think about when you're making these expat decisions, because I know for us, you know, we all make jokes about, oh, we were just going away for 5 years and then we extended it for another couple of years and then we extended it. You know, the woman, Jane, said, oh, we were going away for 10. We ended up being gone for 14. You know, I went for 5 years. It's now been 20. But I think it is that whole thing of you go, oh, well, we'll just stay away for a little bit longer because we'll just get, you know, that person through school, or we'll just get that bit of the mortgage paid, or we'll just get, you know, this bit of travel that we've desperately wanted to do, whatever it is, you know, oh, you know, the Joneses who we love are staying for another three. They've just signed on for another 3 years. Let's sign on for another 3 years of fun with them. All those things. I guess when you're making those decisions, you got to realize what the impact can be back at home.
Yeah, I think that's it. So we have talked about that from time to time because there comes a time where you think, well, within this organization or within this industry, there's only sort of three or four jobs in Australia that I'd be interested in doing and or could do. Mm-hmm. And also then that's often then even reduced further by where you want to live.
Yes.
So do you want to, after being an expat for 20 years or 25 years, do you want to move back and have to move to somewhere you don't want to live? Because isn't the point of going back to Australia or going back to any home country to go back to something that you want to do? So it's a plan, you know, you're going back there. So like Jane was talking about, they're in Brisbane and I was thinking, oh, I wonder if they went to Sydney, would that be a bigger education market? But did they want to live in Sydney? Probably not. Mm. I mean, and we now would talk about, like, we left Sydney and we always thought we would go back, but now we say, oh, we probably wouldn't want to go back to Sydney. Yet Sydney is where a lot of job opportunities are.
Yes.
So it's unless you move back with a job, so someone offers you a job and you say, okay, yeah, I'd take that job. I'll take that job to get me back and I don't mind living there and that's all sorted. You know, outside of that, I think you've got to look at it and think, you know, this could take some time. Like any job, like if you were a person in a city in Australia and your company made you redundant or you left your job for differences of opinion or you were burnt out or you just decided you wanted a career change, you would say, well, I think this is going to take me 3 to 6 months to find something.
Yeah.
Obviously, with Jane, not as long, but it's not that different necessarily to someone who's just sitting there, but it is different from the point of view of what you've got to offer the market and what your level of contacts are.
You know, we had people also who said, no, not a problem at all. This is, I'm loaded for jobs. Nurses, Jenna, who's in the US, she said, I had multiple job offers when I repatriated. I get recruited once a week. And I wonder if that's just nurses worldwide, right? Michelle Rogers said, just to give an alternate alternative, an alternate perspective. We were considering relocating home to Australia after my husband was made redundant in Dubai, weren't having any luck finding another senior position. Recruiters in Australia were really interested in his experience and he was offered a great job in Sydney. At the same time, a really good job came up in Dubai, so we decided to stay put for the moment. We definitely didn't find his overseas experience was a negative at all.
It's not necessarily negative, but it can be. And if I think about all the people I know who have been longer term expats and returned to their home countries, they've all had different experiences. You know, some have returned to start a business, some have returned to buy a business, some have returned and waited to find a job, and some have returned straight to a job.
And the buying a business, I think, is huge in the expat world. And I think you know, when you get to your 50s, maybe that's where you start heading, because if you're someone, you know, like my partner and I, who he thinks, well, I'm never going to get the job I've got now. You know, I'm going to go from traveling internationally. I mean, you know, my partner gets to, oh, I'm going to go and chase up that idea in Singapore next week, and then I'm going to chase up this idea in the Philippines the following week, and then I'm going to go to London for a court hearing the following week. Well, if he moved back to Australia, it would be, yeah, here's your company car, enjoy your drive out to the boondocks. And, you know, that's kind of about it that we'll need you for. And so maybe that's when you go, well, okay, when I'm done with this career, maybe I'm going to do that hobby or passion that I would love to turn into a business. You know, maybe I'm going to do cycling tours in the McLaren Vale area, or I'm going to start.
I can see that business plan's already on your wall, isn't it?
Yeah. There's the cheese. We've got the ice cream and cheese shop that we've named the Fat Cow, that's literally just down the road from our beach house. Right. These are regular discussions that we have, because I think we think, well, also too, for that motivation of that you don't want to come home and be down in the dumps. You know, maybe if you're coming home to something exciting or a new beginning, a new change, I mean, that's an idea as well. Hey, a tip that someone suggested if you're returning to the UK was you should look at Return Hub, who specialise in people with gaps in their CV or wanting to transfer their skills or work flexibility. It's mainly financial positions, I think, too. Someone else suggested something called Women Returners as well. Was that the American one, Nikki?
Could be the American one. I'll check in the group if it is, and if it's not, then I'll pop the American link in the show notes.
Yes.
I also think, just on that, Kirsty, and I was giggling a little bit to myself, I don't know if you saw it on our video connection that we see each other now when we talk, was when you said, I think when you go home in your 50s. And I think if I was listening to this when I was first an expat in my very early 30s, I'd be thinking, oh, 50s, that's so old.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's totally irrelevant to me. But then if you look around at people in their 40s and 50s, they're often also leaving corporate life and pursuing alternative options. So it's also not just an expat thing. It's also wanting more flexibility in your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Maybe when your kids are getting ready to leave the nest, fingers crossed, always a possibility. Although my son went to the college fair yesterday and came home with a very bizarre idea about what he thinks he's going to do when he leaves school. And so he may never leave. But once all those things happen, then it really, you know, you do look for alternatives in your life. And that might be an age and stage thing too. But also with the extra twist of expatness, there's always that extra little bit of information and planning and forethought and different things that come up. But I just also think it might be an age and stage thing.
Yeah, I agree. Well, so often I think we overemphasize it, thinking it's an expat thing. Yeah, and like you said, not realizing, well, actually it's kind of just a worldwide thing. You're not that special. It is just happening everywhere. It's that you might be thinking this is part of your expat life, but it's not. It's just part of life.
Yeah, but it might be you have different views on it or different options given you have come from an expat environment. Like I know friends of mine that I knew in Hong Kong, bankers, they went back to Australia, moved to the Noosa hinterland and started a he was also like an ultra marathoner. So they started a whole business making healthcare bars, you know, like they just built a commercial kitchen and started the whole thing, which was totally different to everything they'd done. But they decided they wanted to have a business. This was a passion of theirs. And here they are now, you know, exporting internationally and, you know, providing things. Yeah, I mean, but you know, I don't know if they weren't sitting in a bar in Hong Kong having, you know, 64 drinks, whether they would have maybe come up with that. I'm not sure. So you can't say which part of that whole idea and experience was part of their expat life and which part was their life just saying, we're going to switch it up a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Other tips that people gave were to use all of your contacts, you know, to really put the word out there. Like someone said, they got an interview via a childhood friend of their brother's. But, yeah, I think one of the pieces of advice I really liked was Vicky Allen, who shared a LinkedIn a link for how to sort of improve your resume. She's had 20 years of recruiting experience, and she said badly written CVs are a big issue, and to tailor your CV specifically for every job you go for. She was saying as a recruiter, you can spot a generic CV immediately and it's very off-putting. And one thing I hadn't thought of, that many large companies just use keyword searches for the first CV sift. So if you haven't mentioned anything from the role description, you won't get past the first post, and how to describe your career breaks. But like I said, this podcast isn't about how to get back into work after a long time. It's really sort of if your expat career is holding you back from getting a job back at home.
And just a reminder on that, with sharing the LinkedIn article, we'll put it in the show notes, but also Two Fat Expats has a LinkedIn group where you just can connect online, just so if there's other fatties in the LinkedIn world, just know you're out there with each other. There you go.
And if you want to tell us about your experience, whether you're a yay or a nay, for if it was hard or it wasn't, come and leave us a message. You can do that by going to twofatexpats.com. You can press the microphone button. It's as easy as leaving a voicemail. Now, Nikki, three favourite things. Tell me one of your favourite things for this week.
Well, one of my favourite things this week, I'm late to the podcast Snowball.
I keep seeing that.
I know. And so I heard about it when it first came out, and then I thought, am I going to listen to it? And then I kept seeing signs everywhere. So I thought, okay, fine. So I was out and about doing things and I started listening and I was hooked.
So what's it about?
It's sort of like Who the Hell is Hamish, but for New Zealand. And so it's about a family in New Zealand. There's three sons. One of the sons was working in the UK, met and fell in love with an American girl, and she moved back to New Zealand. They decided to set up a business. So his parents put up all the cash. You know, they guaranteed everything.
True story.
Wife leaves town, business collapses, wife's never seen again.
Ooh.
And then so the parents lose the business, they lose their home, they lose a lot of things. But it happened 12 years ago. And one of the brothers happens to be a journalist working in Australia. So after all this time, his father has done a lot of research, and so he decides to take it up as a podcast. And it's strange, well, not strangely compelling, it's totally compelling. You know, I'm all into true crime stuff. The two brothers that were not married to the girl go on this tour to America to, you know, trace her footsteps over and her businesses over time, and it turns out might not be a one-off situation. So, it just goes on, and then they end up confronting her. It's a whole. So it's not quite this. It's in the vein or genre of Who the Hell is Hamish, that kind of thing. So it's true, and there's more than one person that's been wronged by this. Particular person, and it's a journalist, but he's got a personal attachment to it because it happened to his family. So, yeah, that's one of my favourite things this week. Totally into it.
Oh, that sounds good. Okay, I'm going to do that one with I've got the teens in the car with me next week. Okay, Nikki, I watched The Last Czars. Have you watched it?
I haven't, but also on my list. I watched it
because a girlfriend had posted it saying she'd watched it over the weekend, rolled the whole series, you know, in one go, absolutely loved it, whatever. Now, I'm glad that she told me that because when I looked up the review on The Guardian, it was absolutely canned, like completely canned for making all of these terrible mistakes. Like supposedly there's a bit where you can see Lennon's tomb in a scene from 1905 when it wasn't actually constructed until 1924, that things were spelt wrong, you know, that the script was wooden. The Guardian called it the Peter and Jane version of Russian history. I thought, I can see all of that, but I also thought it was fantastic. I thought the cinematography is beautiful, and maybe it is a Peter and Jane of Russian history, but maybe I'm someone that required a Peter and Jane of Russian history.
If you haven't read a lot of Russian history or literature, then it's worthwhile.
Yes. And what they did, which was really interesting, I've never seen this before, was it was like, while I say it's part miniseries, part doco, is that it starts off, it's like a proper mini series, and you're like, oh, okay, there's, you know, Nicholas, the last Tsar, and there's his wife, and there's him getting married, and there's his father, and funeral, and da 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 da. I don't know how long you're going along like that. And then, boop, up pops all these historians that walk you through it. So they kind of interrupt it and say,
oh, wow.
They give the backstory. And they're all obviously right into it. Like they have picked people that absolutely love it. And so you've kind of got the little backstory, like what can't be told, they're going to tell you, like how the people were feeling at the time. It was really worth watching for a little history lesson. You probably can't do it with little children because there's a bit of Nudie Rudy in there. One of the weird things they did was a bit like with Chernobyl, they used English accents. Which I can't imagine how the Russians deal with that, but they evidently Chernobyl was, you know, received well by the Russians. But I find it strange.
This is my call on that. If they use Russian accents, why? Because they're speaking English. To me, it doesn't matter what accent they're using, because if they're English people speaking with a pretend Russian accent, they never spoke to each other in English. They spoke to each other in Russian. So when they're speaking in Russian, there are no accents. So I think that the construction of accents in movies and television is a construction of the American media film industry.
Right.
We think they should be speaking with that kind of accent because they're Eastern European or they're Western European or they're Scandinavian. So they should talk with this kind of funny accent when they're talking English, which is only really relevant if you're talking with people who are all different nationalities. I think if you got a miniseries about someone who are all one nationality, if they're not talking the language that they spoke, I don't think it matters what the accent is. That's me. I've been thinking about that a bit since the Chernobyl thing.
Yeah. No, see, I found it off-putting that, okay, we're all going to speak English even though we're Russian, but some of us are going to speak English with a Welsh accent. Some of us are going to speak English with a London accent. Some of us are going to speak English like Rasputin was in this, and his English accent wasn't the same as the Tsar's accent. And then when they'd have a Russian soldier, the Russian soldier would speak with a Russian accent. I found that weird. Like if you're all
Maybe they should all be consistent.
Yeah, but then you're making if you say, okay, you're all going to be, then you say, okay, well, which English accent are we going to use? Are we going to use
I'm fine with them being Welsh and whatever, because obviously Russian has different accents, American have different accents, whatever, but having a Russian soldier speaking with a Russian accent while everyone else has a version of English, that seems weird.
But not if he had a Welsh accent or an Australian accent. Like, what would have you done if the Russian soldier would have suddenly spoken with an Australian accent and the Tsar was speaking with an American accent and the Tsar's wife was speaking with an English accent?
I just think that I have to stand by my theory that if they're not speaking, because if they're speaking English with a Russian accent, all you're doing is making the accent consistent.
Right.
A- and your version of what you think a Russian person speaking English sounds like, which is ridiculous because they were never Russian people speaking English with each other. Anyway, I'm standing by that. It's controversial, I know. I can tell that.
Hey, fun fact, Nikki, Americans spell czar with a C. Brits spell it with a T. I was completely thrown by that. I learned that czar was spelt with a T at school. So when it popped up with the C, I was like, oh God, if I've been spelling it wrong all these years, but I was thinking, how strange. Anyway, moving right along, what other favorite things do you have?
Well, I went to see Downton the movie this week.
Aha. How was it?
It was, if you're a Downton fan, it was great. It was just like one of the Christmas specials. So it's like a long version of an episode.
Right.
I did sit next to somebody who had never seen it before and thought they would just come along for the movie. Now, it was an opening night thing, so it was packed. And, you know, there were people dressed up in hats and fancy things and whatever, and then there was just the rest of us. But what I found was there was a lot of laughing and sort of engaging by the audience in response to, you know, the Dowager saying something or, you know, a particular event happening which had a tie back. So I would kept whispering to the girl beside me, so the backstory on this is, you know, because she was sort of sitting there not understanding why something was particularly funny necessarily. So I would say, look, if you love Downton, I definitely go and see it. It's just like a Christmas special.
Right.
If you've never seen Downton, I don't know how you'd feel about it if you're in a theater full of people who are responding to every sort of little thing.
How did you feel about it when you asked her?
Well, I had to leave very quickly at the end, so I didn't really know. But I think she thought it was fine, but I don't think that she would have enjoyed it as much as everybody else.
Yeah, because
she just looked a little bit confused, not confused, but sort of just like everyone would laugh or giggle and she sort of like look around because it was so noisy. And I'd say, oh, okay, well, the backstory to that. So I didn't sort of say the whole thing. And then there was a theme to do with Thomas the butler who is gay. And obviously everyone at Downton knows that, but there was an interlude with other people. And I sort of went, you know, I was worried something was going to happen. And she said, what's wrong? And I said, oh, you know, backstory is this, you know.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
I look, I enjoyed it. It's one of my favorite things for this week. I'm sticking with it.
Good.
What about you?
Well, one of my favorite things was, you know, Thursday night, which is our Friday night here because our weekend is Friday, Saturday. I always feel the need to explain that to people, especially when I say I'll get onto that on Sunday morning and they think, what? I found myself at home by myself, which was really, really weird because I am down to one child and a husband, I can't remember where he was. Was he traveling? Was he overseas and coming home? I can't remember what happened, but he was out and son, we now live in a compound where he just walks out the door and disappears, you know, for hours and said, oh, I'm going out, I'm going to blah, 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 and walked down with his friends. I suddenly sat down and thought, oh my God, I've got the house to myself. I'm alone. It's Thursday night. What do I do? I don't know what to do. So I scrolled through, I can't remember now if it was iMovies or whether it was Netflix. Actually, no, scrolled through. It was on iTunes. Found the movie The Children Act, which was made in 2017. It's based on a novel by Ian McEwan. Stars Emma Thompson and Stanley Tucci. And Fionn Whitehead. It's a story about a boy who's sort of months away from his 18th birthday, so he's therefore a child in the eyes of the law. He's a Jehovah's Witness and refusing a blood transfusion. The hospital takes the matter to court as they fear he'll die without the blood transfusion. The judge is Emma Thompson, so it's her decision on whether she decides that she will ignore the wishes of his parents and him. Or you know, roll with what the doctors want. I thought it was a great movie if you just want to spend, you know, sometimes we just like things that are visually pleasing. I'm sure that's why I loved Mad Men and, you know, like Downton Abbey or those things, is that they are visually just make you feel all warm and cozy. You know, I had posh London envy the entire time, her house, her commute, her wardrobe, her husband. It was just, it was really visually pleasing. It was a great movie. And my only thing that I wondered about was I felt like maybe I'd missed a bit that the book probably would have told. Do you know, there were a couple of scenes where I thought, I'm sure the book would give me a much better idea of why that just happened. The feeling between the boy who needs the transfusion and Emma Thompson develop a relationship, which of course she's very professional and sort of English uptight and is not letting that happen, but keeps having to try and push him away. And the husband announces very early on in the movie that he's about to go and embark on an affair, that he doesn't want to leave her, but he wants to have an affair because he's not getting the physical side of the relationship from her. So it's quite, you know, it's quite, I think the book would have given me a lot more depth, but thought it was a great sort of Thursday night glass in hand movie.
Excellent.
All right, Nikki, down to number three for you. What's your third favorite thing?
Okay, so my last favorite thing for this week is I've also been listening to some podcast crossover events. Ooh. So when one podcast and another podcast get together and they do an event, so they have a little bit of the favorite things from both of their podcasts. So one of the things is The Guilty Feminist has been doing a series of those. So The Guilty Feminist, one of my favorite podcasts, and they crossed over with No Such Thing as a Fish, which is another family-friendly podcast, I always say, if your kids are a little bit older. So I enjoyed that. And the other one is, I did notice last week as well, Kirsty, one of your our joint favorite podcasts also did a crossover. So Don't Shoot the Messenger did a crossover with The Outer Sanctum.
Oh.
Or half of the people from The Outer Sanctum. Did you listen to that episode, Kirsty?
I haven't yet. I haven't. I have been so involved with the football podcast, which I may have been listening to just before you and I logged on, and that's why I had my little speaker here and it interfered with us. Yes, it's AFL Grand Final week. So
I know
everything is happening, and AFL Trade Radio kicked off today because once the final is over, we hit the trade period, and 3 weeks of the trade period is just bliss. And so I have been a little bit consumed by that and work, unfortunately. I love Don't Shoot the Messenger, as you know, and I'm a big fan of The Outer Sanctum as well. I mean, obviously they are my spirit animals because they're women who love football and sit around and talk about it, and I could quite happily do that all day. And Nikki, my third favourite thing is the book fairies. So we have moved, we've downsized, which meant that I had about 5 boxes of books, both books for me and books for my children. Notice the way I didn't say adult books, because I know that that can give people very different ideas of what sort of books I'm reading, but they weren't. They were grown-up books and kids' books. Anyway, I discovered the book fairies, and the book fairies came to my house and they took all my books away. And what the book fairies do, I thought it was just a Qatar thing. It's not. It's a worldwide thing. The book fairies leave books in public places for people. So you may hit the train station or the bus stop or the airport or wherever, and you will find a book, and it'll have a sticker on the front of it saying that I've been left to you by the book fairies, and please pass me on to someone else when you're done. I think it's beautiful. Anyway, there's one in Qatar. I'm not sure how it works in the expat sense, in that I have moved to some countries where I have had to list every single book that I am importing into the country, like Libya.
Yes.
I had to list every book and every CD or DVD, showing my age. But I have got a feeling in Qatar that when you bring literary things into the country, that they are checked by customs. So I'm not sure on how that breaks rules or whatever, but you would think that if it was already in the country, well, then that's okay. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it did cross my mind when I was, it was more sort of kids' books, you know, like Noah's Ark and, you know, things like that where I was thinking, oh, I'm not quite sure how that works. I think it works. I'd like to think that that's fine, but I'm really not sure what the rules are.
Okay, Kirsty, anything this week for I Spy with my expat eye?
Yeah, I guess going back to the Indian cooking class, I realized by standing in Reena's kitchen, because Reena is an expat, you know, she's from India. She's actually got a really interesting story. She was an expat kid who was an expat in Dubai, and so she raised by an Indian family, and then she moved back to India for a while, then to London, then to Qatar. But I realized so much that you can learn from your friends, because, I mean, Reena wasn't a chef. This is something she is just teaching people how she cooks at home. And even then, you know, without her being a chef and just showing me how she cooks at home, it was all so much in her technique and things that I thought, wow, I would have never thought of doing that. And I can't believe that you just live down the road and you can teach me all these amazing things and you're not actually a chef. You're just Reena from down the road who can impart all these knowledge. And it was little things like, Nikki, we made butter chicken, and so imagine you've marinated chicken for 24 hours. You know, she did the whole spectacular, she taught you how to do it, and, oh, here's one I prepared earlier and pulled it out of the fridge. But before it went in the oven, so she's got, imagine the chicken is sitting in a, you know, silver bowl. It's all marinated. It's been marinated for 24 hours. She gets a little silver cup and makes a hole in the middle of the bowl, puts the silver cup in, and then she grabs a piece of charcoal from the barbecue, puts the charcoal on top of the hob on the stove, heats it up high, so gets the piece of charcoal boiling hot, you know, just by putting it on top of the stove and twisting around. She gets a bit of ghee, pours the ghee into the bottom of the silver cup, puts the charcoal in, it immediately smokes up everywhere, puts the lid on top of the bowl, like puts just any old frying pan lid on top of the bowl. So all of a sudden it's all just got this barbecue smoke. And it's like, wow, I just thought how simple it was to smoke something.
Like, Yeah.
It was everything from her getting her chilies whole and grinding them herself. She's got a coffee grinder there, but it's got another little attachment. So she grinds all her own spices. And so you could see, I didn't know that there was Kashmiri chili that doesn't have any heat, but it's got all the flavor. You know, there was, I just learned so much, but it also just made me realize, and I think I said this in the Facebook group, so often you kind of look at people who've had such a different upbringing than you, who come from somewhere so unrelated, and I think food is just the most perfect way. And you know that, Nikki, from doing your cookbook club of all getting together and you know, make something together. But food is just a great way of keeping things non-political or keeping the conversation light. But learning and sharing and sitting down for a meal together. And I feel stupid that I've even brought it up as a, you know, I spy with my little expat eye, but it just was a reminder for me, a big reminder.
No, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. So that's good. I'll try and find something this week. I feel like you're all up in the expat eyes, but I'm not. I'm looking around with, I'm not sure what eyes I'm using.
Just a quick update, Nikki. How's the visa husband situation going? So you got your husband home for the weekend, last weekend, right?
Yep. So at the moment he's doing week about, so he's here this week. But on Sunday, we drop my son to the airport. He's going to London for a theatre workshop, an IB theatre workshop. And then we drive to Copenhagen again for the afternoon, where I'm driving him up to his new apartment with all his bedding and the things he needs. And so my daughter will be home by herself, so I'll drive back on Sunday night.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, this theatre workshop, has this got something to do with what you were saying before about your son picking a new career?
So from nowhere, he's come home yesterday and said, this is what I'm going to do. This is what university I'm going to, and this is what course I'm going to do.
Fantastic.
I said, okay, that's great. Well, that's solved. Let's put that away then. And the college fair, he said, it took me 20 minutes to find it. I said, oh, goodness, that's a long time you've dedicated there. And he's going to do a Bachelor of Arts in stage and screen acting, which not sure where that's come from. Obviously, he's had an interest in doing voiceover and that kind of stuff from when he did his audiobook last year. But he is, this year, he's in the musical at school in Rent, the musical. He's playing the role of Tom Collins, which is one of the more major roles. Apparently, he has songs that he sings by himself and all sorts of things. So where my husband and I are just fascinated and very much looking forward to going to see him.
Now, is this an expensive option, choosing university in London?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that, because I did have a look, and this particular university charges the same for British students and international students, which I thought was very fair. Yeah. And it was £18,000 a year for the university. And then I looked, I said, well, I'm sure these things exist in Australia. So I went and had a look in Australia, and an equivalent course at QUT in Queensland is $31,000 a year. So I thought, well,
so that's about the same.
It's not that much different. So my husband's like, oh, well, maybe we can, you know, go to another country where it's cheaper. And I said, well, in Australia, it's not that much cheaper. So we'll see.
Would it be that if he did it in Australia, he'd pay through his own hex bill, but if he does it in England, you pay for it up front. Right.
That's
my decision made already.
I did point out to him that there are other countries with the same course, but he said, but what I want is, it gives me an idea about what marks I have to get. I said, well, sweetheart, as you can see, the main thing for most of these courses is the audition. So let's concentrate. But anyway, he's going to this amazing course. So they're going to London for 4 nights. They're going to see Fame, Come From Away, which is a musical about September 11, when all the planes landed in Newfoundland.
Uh-huh.
And that tiny little town took on thousands and thousands of people overnight. So they've made a musical about that, which I didn't realize.
Yeah.
And then he's going to see a play on the third night, Grown Ups. And then during the day, they have all these with different international schools from around the world, the theatre students from the DP program, they have all these workshops and, you know, all sorts of things. So he's doing theatre for as one of his subjects, obviously.
These poor, tortured third culture kids. It's tough.
The International School of Morocco, there's an international school from Spain going. There's all these all these amazing places. I said, oh, that's so exciting. I wish I was doing it.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, I will leave you to it then, Nikki. Have a great week. I'll see you next week.
You too. Speak to you later. Bye.